Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects with our guest entomologist, Phil Pelletieri. Back to talk about the bugs that come in on your Christmas tree or your other plants, and certainly answer your insect questions, any insect questions that you have. Maybe you even have a photo of an insect you want to identify, or just to show it off a bit. You can email us that to ideas@wpr.org, or if you just want to talk to us, you can call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Give a call. Love to hear from you. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
You know, I saw a cartoon the other day in somebody's home, and their Christmas tree was up, and there was a squirrel sticking its head out of the tree. And you'd like to think that you'd notice a squirrel, but in your tree, but insects are another matter. They're a little smaller. What kinds of insects can come in with a Christmas tree?
Well, it's not overly common, but typically what would happen about this time of the year is somebody would send a critter they found at their windows and wonder what it was. And the most common one that I would see are aphids. The aphids on Christmas trees and conifers tend to be rather large for aphids and dark colored. And depending on the type of pine or whatnot, I mean, they're different species. And, you know, the little winged critters, it would probably remind somebody more of a small gnat. And they're really harmless, other than some of those aphids, if you crush them, can stain things. So you got to be a little careful, you know, whether you use a little vacuum cleaner or the like. And it usually is a very short-lived phenomenon. It goes a couple, 3 days, and it seems to run its course. The other one I have seen, especially in the firs, there's a little critter that we call a gall midge, and it causes a little swelling, almost like a little tumor on the needles, and that's where the critter's living. And again, what's happening here is these trees, when they're brought inside, the insects are tricked into thinking it's spring, and then you get this emergence. So again, a little gnat-like creatures show up. But, you know, it's not something we would never spray the Christmas tree, of course, and I've never seen it bad enough that you could justify taking the tree back outside. But as I said, I think the main thing I'd be careful of is just being a little careful if critters are accumulating somewhere, is to be a little gentle when you dispatch them or take them outside.
Okay, so not much really to do if you find any.
No, I've never seen it to the point that I you could justify getting rid of the tree. And a few years back, there was kind of this urban legend that deer ticks were hiding out in Christmas trees, and that really is not a place that deer ticks would like to be at any time. And so they said it was just one of those kind of rumors that was bounding around. But I've really never had concern, and I've been lucky enough. I don't ever remember any critters coming in on any Christmas trees we bought over the years.
No, I don't have any on mine this year, I don't think, anyway. Well, what about some of the plants we bring inside in the fall? Of course, it's a little late now, but what should we be doing to stop them next year?
Yeah, well there's two concerns. I think one of the most common things that we see is plants that were left outside that seem to do just fine. You bring them in the house, and all of a sudden you get an outbreak of spider mites. And those spider mites were probably on the plants outside, but the high humidity and general environment is not conducive for them doing well. They like it hot and dry, and when you bring a plant inside during the heating season, it sees hot and dry. So that's one of the concerns. The second one that's really quite common are the little fungus gnats that breed in the soil. And, you know, they don't hurt the plants at all, but all of a sudden, again, you get these little gnat-like things showing up, whether they're flying in your eyes or, again, showing up at the windowsills. And, you know, for spider mites, there are some insecticidal soaps that work pretty well. The big problem with mites is that nothing kills the eggs, so you usually have to put a second treatment on about 10 or 14 days after the first to catch those eggs that have hatched. Fungus gnats, the concern to me is some of the remedies are worse than the critters, because you know, if you just throw any insecticide on there, some of the carriers insecticides cause root damage, and so that will set the plant back, and in some cases even downright kill it. And plus, you know, pets and kids, we don't usually like to use things if we don't have to, and so one of the alternatives for fungus gnats, it takes a little bit of homework to find it, but there are some bacterial insecticides that only affect, in fact, it's the same ones we use against mosquitoes. So they're really environmentally very selective. They sell as the name Nat Out or Nat All, or you know, there's a number of products. The product is a form of Bacillus thuringiensis, or what we call BT, but it's a special strain for killing flies. And so you can buy this and, again, apply it to the soil and just normal drenching. And it will not kill the adults, but they're very short-lived. It kills the maggots. And so you basically shut down the breeding, and it's very mellow on the plants. And so they said usually you'll have to go to a bigger garden center. The chance of finding it at a hardware store is probably somewhat remote because they just don't have a broad enough product line. But I think that's a great solution to take care of it. And again, then you don't have to worry about pets or anybody, and it will solve the problem.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I know you want to talk about ants in the house, and isn't it strange to see ants in the winter?
Well, yeah, but it's the dead giveaway that they've got to be someplace that's warm. You know, you figure most insects, it has to be above 50 degrees for them to be active. And so, you know, it tells you they're nesting indoors, and we're somewhat limited to the ants that we see. Now, if you see them at this time of the year, you know, one possibility is you can bring ants in firewood. So, you know, that carpenter ants and the like sometimes hitchhike along that. But probably the most active ones I see are pavement ants. Because they can kind of nest anywhere, and that's kind of a pretty small reddish-brown ant. Seems to eat almost anything. And then carpenter ants maybe, but, it's interesting. Carpenter ants seem to, for the most part, go relatively dormant and will show up in January or February more often than not. But, again, the normal outside ants we don't see until May typically. So anytime you see ants, that tells you that you got something active where in probably not even your outside walls, because there might be a little bit too cold for them to be active in most winter days. But, we always preach to find the nest, but really a better thing to do for this kind of problem is to see what they seem to be fond of eating and then buy the appropriate bait so that they can take the bait, feed it back to the rest of the colony and wipe the colony out that way. So, sometimes it's worth taking a little bit of cooking oil and a little bit of honey and put it on a piece of wax paper and see if they have a preference. Some ants will eat both, and that makes it a little easier to find a bait. But you want to match the bait to whatever kind of food preference they show.
A listener emailed, he had, excuse me, he had a lasting population. Gee, I suddenly lost my voice here. You know what? Let's go to Peter in Eden. He found a spider on his basement floor, I think. Can you see it?
This great big colorful spider? I got one in an email that looks like an Argiopa, what we call a garden spider. These are really common in the late summer, a number of different species, although the true garden spiders tend to be this yellow and black combination. In normal circumstances, they die out in November when things go, and they overwinter as eggs in an egg case. And so this one probably just wandered in. And in most of what you see are the big females, so they're big and colorful and kind of scary looking to most people, but they're really very harmless. And it's at a basement. It is not a spider that we expect to breed indoors. It's an outside critter that makes those great big orb webs. In fact, that's the family are called the orb web weavers.
Well, a listener emailed that he has had a lasting population of what he thinks are drain flies.
Mm-hmm.
His plumber told him to put water, pour water in the basement drain, and that didn't work.
Sure.
It's been since summer when he, I say he didn't have plants in the house. Small black wings don't look like fruit flies.
Yeah, drain flies are sometimes referred to as moth flies, and they have hairs on their wings. And if you crush them, they often leave a bit of a powder. And the name is common of the environment, but what it is the accumulated crud and organic matter. And you find when you flush water, you usually are, if that stuff is caked, you're not moving it. Another mistake people make at times is to try bleach. What I used to tell people is, when we want to sterilize the outside of an insect, when we're doing experiments, we use bleach water. It doesn't kill the insect, but it sterilizes the skin. And that's because they're like little plastic critters is what they really are. So my first thing is, you know, is it drain flies or is it these fungus gnats that we talked about that come out of potting soil? And that's why it's important with these little gnat-like things to get a proper ID so you're pointed in the right direction. Now, I have seen drain flies breed in bathroom sinks, in the overflow cuts, or even the sink itself if you get an accumulation of material. Floor drains in the basement, maybe, but I don't think most of us get enough organic matter flushed there to cause that as a source. You know, you're probably better to go along, if it is true drain flies, with some kind of biological degrading product that cuts to the scum. And if you cut through the scum, and then you can flush it with water, but you need something to help you. So there are various products you can get at hardware stores and in bigger box stores that are made for treating that. Now, there are still some other things. So as I said, I guess if this has been ongoing as long as it has, it'd be worth it to get a couple of them and send them to PJ at the diagnostic lab so he can give you a proper ID. And then, as I said, once you got an idea of the kind of environment they're looking for, they're a little easier to clean up. Which, by the way, it's probably worth mentioning, PJ and his wife Sarah are now proud parents of a young little lad. So we have another budding entomologist coming through. So we're all excited about that.
He's excited and I think a little tired.
I have witnessed that too, but you know, that's being a new parent.
That's being a new parent. Yeah, we'll have him on again as well to talk about maybe that, but other insects too. So, and it's the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. If you put that into your search engine, that's going to pop up, and you can send a photo that way. So there you go.
Yeah, for the photo, you know, it helps. You know, you need a pretty good camera, or at least something that's good at taking pictures of small critters, because some of these gnats are small enough that we need to look at their wings and the lines and the wings and whatnot to tell exactly who it is. But by far, you know, the drain fly thing, I tend to find more often I look at my bathroom sinks as a source. You know, and sometimes you can even just use a brush to get rid of that kind of crud buildup. But that interface is where they are. And we used to see them just in the summer here. And again, I knew it was my bathroom, so cleaned them up. But never in the winter, which is always was curious to me. I don't know if the temperature of the pipes were just cool enough to prevent them from developing or what. But they were almost seasonal, although you wouldn't expect it because indoors, of course, the environment is always pretty much the same.
Yeah. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, our guest today on the show. Join in with your questions. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, and Tyler Ditter is our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at the world of insects today with our entomologist, Phil Pelletieri, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus at the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He retired from there in 2014. Questions for him about insects. Do you have any bothering you, or maybe just have a question about a particular insect or an experience to share? Maybe you've got a photo of an insect you want to have Phil maybe identify from that. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Sarah in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello, Larry and Phil. I had my best bug experience I've ever had was this at late at night, a beating on my slider, kitchen window. It was open. It was a hot night, and I was like, "What is that noise?" Got closer to the screen. It was a Luna moth. I was just astonishing, really. I've never seen anything like it. Probably 3 or 4 years later, on my deck right by the screen, you know, my screen looks out onto the deck, was an enormous green caterpillar. I'd never seen anything as big as that. And, you know, I finally figured out probably it was a Luna moth caterpillar. Since then, not seen anything. And I'm wondering if it was a gypsy moth spraying and if you knew the status of Luna moths in Wisconsin.
Status of Luna moths.
Luna and all the other wild silkworms, and we have four or five pretty common species, are, if you're in the right place, really quite common. But there's a couple things going on. The adults of all those critters are very short-lived. They don't feed, and honestly, they are very much prone to bat predation, and so they don't last very long. And if you think about it, when they're out flying at night, you know, they're not overly quick. They don't really have any mechanisms to defend themselves. And so I find a lot of times they don't survive more than a day or two. The other thing that happens to some degree is that in cities, even though we have the right trees, you know, walnuts and whatnot are some of the host trees that Luna in particular, and then you get Cecropia that feed on apple and like, so we got plenty of the trees. But it's a kind of environment with all this light competition that a lot of them just get mixed up. And so if I'm going to go look for them, honestly, we go out into the dark woods and use lights to attract them. And then we tend to do a little bit better. There have been some studies, some of these even go back 20 or 30 years ago, that some of the parasites that were brought in to control gypsy moth, especially some of the fly parasites, were also affecting some of these wild silkworms. Although, interesting enough, the study seemed to show a lot more problems on the East Coast than it did in the Midwest. They seemed to have less impact. But, you know, I find in the city it's just not very common to see them. And even in the country, you know, it kind of, as I said, have to be at the right place at the right time. Luna never seemed to be very common in the Madison area, although I have a nephew who is very fond of wild silkworms, and he seemed to get lucky enough. And he's just out towards Verona, but he lives basically on a farm, and they have a great big wild marsh and stuff. So, again, I think he's in the right environment. So I think that's more, you know, what's going on around you in pretty much urban environments are just not conducive for wild silkworms to be very high. Although I did find a Polyphemus cocoon this past spring, and was lucky enough to collect it and let my grandson experience seeing this thing emerge. So
very cool. Very cool. Sarah, thank you very much for calling. Dale in De Pere, it's your turn. Hi, Dale.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I use fung oil, F-U-N-G, on evergreen trees. When your bottom branches start dying and everything else, you spray that really good and then make sure you overlap a little bit so it sinks in the ground to get rid of the fungus. And you can also use it on plants. There's one thing you should think about, though, is that when you're killing all the bugs and the bees around your plants or gardens, then you don't have any blossoms on your plants. Have you ever used that fung oil, F-U-N-G?
Well, you know, we have been using oils against insects for a long time. The most common ones were called dormant oils, which are oils that would burn plants if they were actively growing. But we'd use those against scales and the eggs of spider mites and the like. And then they came out with some more highly refined oils. The problem sometimes isn't the oils, but some of the contaminants that cause the plant burns. And so some of these light oils, again, have been used at contact for soft-bodied insects. So things like aphids and even the mites would work. Hard-bodied things like beetles pretty much aren't affected. They're protected by the thick skin that they've got. So, yes, oils have insecticidal properties, and it wouldn't surprise me at all that the oils that you're using for fungus control also had insecticidal properties. But as you said, you got to be careful. And usually the product is quite clear about its potential burning plants. They often have temperature requirements. You know, you don't want to put them on when it's real hot or those kind of things because that often increases the amount of plant burn.
Dale, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Connie in Coon Lake, Minnesota. It's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I've been experiencing the last, I want to say, at least 3 years, if not more, of these Japanese beetles in the summertime in the garden, and they come and devour everything. And they're really pretty, but they're, like I said, they're just, they ruin a whole garden. I guess looking forward to next year, next season, next spring, what should I do different so I don't get those back?
Okay, there is nothing that you can do that's going to make a difference. the problem with Japanese beetle, and it's interesting because, you know, we're about 20 years plus into the activity in the Madison area. And they fly from half a mile away, and they feed on a wide variety of plants. And so, you know, it's not like I can say, well, you do this to your property and you will stop the breeding. Their grubs are in the soil. They feed on grass. But, you know, most of the time it's not – the numbers are very low in most of our lawns, but in my case, I live two blocks from a golf course, and when it got crazy, that's where they were coming from, and, you know, we'd see densities of 100 grubs per square foot, so you can imagine how many beetles were flying out from the golf course. But the interesting thing to watch, and I've talked about this before on the show, is over time, you know, it got to the point after the first 5 or 6 years, it got to be like a science fiction movie. There were so many beetles and eating everything in the yard, it seemed. But then all of a sudden, the population started to crash. And we have been at that crash level now for well over 10 years. And that seems to be the pattern, that it's a buildup. They get from a minor annoyance to a major annoyance to, as I said, like a horror movie. And then over time, it gets better. And so you know, you can protect plants. There's all kinds of products, and they're continuing to develop new ones, some that are biologically a little bit less intrusive. But the problem is whatever you treat your plants with, protect them for a week or so, and then you have to reapply. And these things are usually active for most of July and August, and depending on the year, even into September. So you got, you know, multiple treatments. In some cases, people have built cages or used netting or other ways to physically protect it. But as I said, the sad news is I can't tell you anything that's going to make a difference for you as far as what you can do to prevent them from coming, because they're coming from down the road.
Connie, thanks very much for calling. Unfortunately, that is the case. Well, you can join in too, by the way. Open lines get you on quickly at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Ryan emailed that he loves finding snow fleas in the spring snow, and he's never been super curious about them, or he's always been, I'm sorry, he's always been super curious about them. Are they related to Calembula?
Yes. Calembula is the fancy name. We call them springtails typically because many, not all, but many species have this little device that they use as a spring and push off, and so you get this jump. So that's where the term snow flea comes. Now, snow fleas typically are species of springtails that are dark-bodied. Springtails live in the soil, feed on organic matter in tremendous numbers at times, and there's a certain group that seem to come out very early. And typically it's not unusual to see them even in late February through March and April. And, you know, on a good sunny day, they're emerging from the soil and they kind of get trapped on the top of the snow. And then, of course, the wind blows them. So, you know, you can see snow fleas piled a half inch deep next to a tree trunk sometimes when you're going out for a nice spring walk and the like. And so they're really quite interesting critters. And then you come back a week later and they've disappeared. Well, they're back down in the soil is really what goes on, the ones that survive. And so, it's a neat phenomena. And you can see again with that hopping motion that they do why they were given the name flea, because that's what fleas do too, is they hop or jump pretty well.
David in Rhinelander, your turn now. Hi, David.
Hi. I kind of wanted to comment and maybe give a caution. I just read a little blurb and then communicated with people at Xerxes Society, and they were trying to find out why monarchs are declining. And they did a study, and they looked at a lot of places, even remote natural areas, and they scanned for over 600 pesticides, herbicides, that kind of thing. And they found everywhere there were at least 100 contaminants, and some of them were above the LD50 level, and it kind of makes you want to be cautious in terms of using pesticides, herbicides, insecticides any place because apparently they persist, and who knows what the long-term effects are in terms of not only the insects but the critters that feed on them, like bats and birds.
Well, definitely. I will tell you, though, you know, being kind of an old guy, what I have witnessed is, for the most part, anytime a chemical lasts for a long time in the environment, it's kind of a red flag because it shows up a bunch of places it doesn't belong. And again, you worry about these interactions. And for the most part, now this is insecticides, and you know, that's my area. I can't really speak to the fungicides and like. But the products have had much shorter half-lives. They degrade quicker. And in particular, we've seemed to come up with more selective products. Now, that doesn't mean that they're all without issue because, again, one of the most selective insecticides are the variations of these bacteria, the Bacillus thuringiensis. But it turns out that the toxin that's in there, if you were to feed it to a monarch caterpillar, it would kill that too because that's what they are. They kill caterpillars by goofing up their digestive system. But they degrade quickly. So if you put it on your broccoli plant to kill the little white worms, it really doesn't pose the monarchs much threat because the monarch caterpillars will not feed on broccoli, and the product degrades quick enough that it's not going to show up, you know, down the road in a natural environment. So, yes, we have to be concerned. And then the other thing that's always an issue that's hard to address is the interactions of various pesticides. You know, it's kind of like an organic soup. And, you know, people try to do those studies, but when you start throwing 100 different combinations in there, you can see how hard it is to really understand all the things. So, yeah, that's the bottom line is, when you're using products, you try to find things that are short-lived and selective as possible to prevent some of these things. But as I said, it's interesting to me because the chemicals that were here when I started my career were far, I mean, we judge a product by how long it lasts. It's called a half-life. And basically, how long does it take for half of it to degrade? You know, back in the day when I started, we had pesticides that the half-life was 20 and 30 years. Now, you know, generally we find we're talking days, if not less, for most of the products. So, as I said, we have made some progress, but it's, you know, the way you approach pesticides is kind of like everything. Each has its own personality. So just because something is related to something doesn't necessarily mean it has the same characteristics. So there are still some pesticides that have long residuals and show up in places they don't belong.
There you go, David. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Sam in Leeds, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Sam.
Hi, I want to make a refuge for the bees. I'm surrounded by cropland, and they pretty much decimated them in my area. And my thought is that if I can plant a stand of clover, that might be helpful. So my questions are this. Would, say, 800 feet of square feet of clover be adequate to be meaningful? And what kind of clover would be the best?
Boy, different varieties favor different bees, but any clover is better than none. You know, when you look at the big picture of the literally 100, I think we officially have 400 different species of native bees in the state. And what has caused them as much problem as anything else is the lack of environmental diversity. You know, a big cornfield or a big bean field is basically a desert. But when you have fence rows and woodlots and other things, you're creating habitat that many of these bees can then breed in. And then, of course, they need a nectar source. And so, you know, one of the big things that we've seen in the last 10 years, aside from an appreciation for native bees, is understanding some of this dynamic and starting to come out with pollinator gardens. And, you know, on a federal basis, farmers are getting money to plant special, you know, small acreages of blooming plants to basically support the bees. And clover is one thing, but, you know, a wide variety because, you know, certain bees have certain preferences. And so, again, the more diversity you've got in flowering plant material, the more bees you're kind of support. But aside from just the plants, again, you have to start looking at this kind of, you know, fence rows and you know, even dead trees, honestly, provide habitat for certain species of bees that breed in the little wood borer holes and the like that are there. And so the more diversity you have there, the better things will go.
Yeah, and those pollinator gardens, you might want to think about that, Sam, something along those lines, or native plantings would be, you know, you get a variety in there, as Phil was saying, and you're going to attract a lot of very useful and beneficial bees and other insects as well. So thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Leslie in Chautauqua next. Hi, Leslie. Oh, we lost Leslie. Let's go to Barbara in Grand Marsh. Hi, Barbara.
I was wondering if those Japanese beetles bite, because I had in my bed, my leg had a couple of bites on it and my arm, and I was really panicked. I thought maybe it was bed bugs, and then I took the blankets back, and there were two of those beetles in my bed. Do they bite or just stink?
Yeah, not really. They have little spines on their legs, so if you pick them up, they're kind of scratchy. You know, I've seen that happen, so it kind of gets your opinion. And again, anytime you got a critter in your hand, you start feeling something. You know, people are inclined to think, is it getting ready to bite? But no, their mouth parts are not structured in a way. So I wonder if you got exposed to something else and that caused the reactions. And you know, it's so difficult at times because, even if you go to a doctor and you show what the bite looks like, you know, we're all just guessing. There's a handful of possibilities. But normally when you think of things that bite on purpose, you start talking about fleas and those kind of things. But definitely Japanese beetle, nothing to worry about there.
Let's take another call. Paul in La Crosse, on to you now. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I got two questions. I just thought of another one. One is with regard to mason bees. And the other one, which was my primary question, is regard to jumping worms. The person I talked to begin with said they aren't up in La Crosse, but are they coming this way?
I would never say, if you were to ask me professionally, are they not in La Crosse, I would not go that far. Because they are often associated with potting soil and we're all buying plants and moving around, jumping worms are moving all over, and it just takes somebody to kind of discover it. It's interesting to watch. You know, we started here in Madison that the first documented ones were at the University Arboretum, which has a plant sale. So they were bringing a lot of plant material in. So this is going back, I'm guessing now maybe 15 years or so.
Yeah, about that.
So, you know, we've all been very careful, and be darned, about 3 years ago, after a heavy rain, we're walking in the backyard, and we've got jumping worms. You know, and yeah. I have no idea where they showed up. But as I'm walking around the neighborhood, my whole neighborhood's got jumping worms. And the good news so far from watching what's happening in our garden, I can't identify anything that is suffering because of them. And there are ongoing experiments that have been going out there breeding because, you know, worms we know have the biggest potential of causing a big problem is in natural environments because they change the soil structure. They're taking organic matter out, causing all kinds of problems there. So, as I said, as they're studying it, there's some concerns, and the studies aren't done yet. But my guess is every time I see, you know, the DNR has probably been keeping as much on the tracking of jumping worms as anybody. And I continue to see new pop-up sites. And generally, I expect in urban environments where there's, you know, a lot of plant material moving around, I would not be surprised if they're in the area. But this is why you're cautious when you're buying plants. We know many of the nurseries and whatnot have changed the way they handle their plant material to lessen the probability of this and the like. But, you know, the difficulty is that once you get them, there is no cure per se. Other than what I hope for in the long run is something I witnessed with a lot of these invasives, is that when they first get there, they get to be the most problematic, but over time they come into more of a balance. And so we'll see. I'm probably not going to live long enough to see this one through, but that is my optimistic opinion of it, because as they said, I witnessed that with so many different species of insects during my career that, as they said, tended to be very problematic early, but then tended to balance out over time. And as I had mentioned with the talk about Japanese beetle, that's what's happened in my area and what I witnessed in other parts of the state. But it's about a 10 or 15 year cycle.
Yeah. There you go, Paul. Thank you. Ron in Madison, let's go to you now. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. Thanks, Dr. Phil. Has the population of monarch butterflies in and around Wisconsin increased in the past 10 years? The background, earlier this month, one of the WPR networks broadcast a short documentary or news story about a forester in Mexico, and he didn't want to do it, but other people's kind of forced him to rehabilitate the natural landscapes where the monarchs overwinter. There was severe erosion. People had been trying to grow food, I suppose, but he managed to get some vegetation back on the eroding soils. And so I'm wondering, was that successful? Have monarch populations in North America increased?
Yeah, it depends a bit on the year. The Monarch Watch project, I think, is still out of Kansas and whatnot, that documenting the larger thing. You know, what I watched in Wisconsin is that some years it seems that we have very good reproduction in high populations. It turns out that overall in North America, the populations crash. What has been the biggest concern really is the overwintering habitat in Mexico, because as the environments have changed, as logging has reduced the areas, you've got everything concentrated in a small area. And so certain weather patterns or whatnot can just be devastating. You know, one winter storm at the wrong time can just absolutely knock the population back 90%. And then you hope that in the longer run, what I'm more optimistic for, I think, is as we've understood this and people are planting, small gardens and putting a lot more milkweed out there and the like, is we're just providing more habitat. So, this past year, what I witnessed, the monarchs seemed to be maybe a little below normal. But 2 years ago, I saw outstanding numbers. But as I said, what was interesting is when you watch what comes out of Mexico and their predictions, especially once we get through the winter into the spring, what they see when the populations start to migrate, what we come from. I mean, the good news about insects is they have such a high reproductive potential that if things go right, you can recover very quickly. But as I said, it sometimes deceptive, because you see what's happening in our own backyard and you get an opinion that may or may not agree with what's happening on a wider scale. And again, I think the general concern more than anything else is the overwintering habitat. And then on top of it, how we can be selective of where we spray and provide more habitat and those things to give monarchs a better chance to build their populations up when they're up here, so more migrate down there, which gives us a better chance of keeping the populations somewhat stable.
Yeah. Ron, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus, our guest on the show today. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of insects with our guest, entomologist Phil Pelletieri. Hope you're having fun listening in. I sure am. And you can join in, too. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a couple of emails. Mike in Beaver Dam emailed that he has the smallest ant that he's ever seen. Feral ants? P-H-E-R-O? Feral ants? How does he get rid of them?
Yeah, okay. So feral ants look almost identical to thief ants, what we call sometimes grease ants here. And it's important to tell the difference, because one is kind of native and one is not native and not so much fun to have. And there is no way he can look close enough, because honestly, we have to put them under the microscope and look to see if they've got two or three segments in the little antennal club. But pharaoh ants are sometimes considered a plague. That's where we think the name came from, because they have multiple colonies, multiple queens. They eat everything. They're just miserable, and they're not overly common. But this is one of those cases. If you had pharaoh ants, they'd be active all year long. Doesn't matter, bothering you. Whereas thief ants are really much more seasonal, and they are outside critters that just kind of invade and feed on waxy things. So here, baits are the way to go. But I'll be honest with you, if I was sure that they were pharaoh ants, I would go the extra step of ordering specific baits made for controlling pharaoh ants. What my fear is that the baits that you get at the hardware store just aren't targeted well enough, whereas there are baits that you can get from these, you know, do-your-own pest control sites that are made for it. And the secret with pharaoh ants is you have to keep feeding them, and you do not let off the gas until you're sure you've controlled the problem. Because if you bait them just for a while and then you take the bait away because you think you've solved the problem, because they have multiple queens, multiple nests, they can resurge quite quickly. So you have to be quite diligent. The other thing is they don't migrate very far. And so if you had an apartment complex that is infested, you have to treat, you know, each one of the units and the like. And so, you know, in those settings, honestly, it's worth getting a professional to come in, because it is not the easiest thing. In the average home, I think you've got a chance to solve it. But as I said, if you were convinced that they were truly pharaoh ants, this, again, is a case, if, you know, you got some specimens, send them to the diagnostic lab, and PJ can determine for sure that they are pharaoh ants. It is important to tell the difference, because they said thief ants come in the spring and summer, and you can see lots of ants running around the kitchen, but I would not expect to see a thief ant at this time of the year, because they're living in the soil, and it's way too cold for them to be active.
Trevor, by the way, called to say he's been bitten by Asian lady beetles.
The difference is not Japanese beetle. You know, the people confuse it. Japanese beetle eat your plants and, you know, are kind of iridescent green and the like. Asian lady beetles are the ones that people think are technically a species of ladybug, and they do bite, and definitely, and what we think is going on there is that they're so hungry they taste anything, but their jaw is like a little piece of pliers, so it doesn't break the skin. I mean, it pinches, it gets your attention, but it would not leave much of a mark at all, as I said, versus something that normally bites for a living, has more of a straw-like mouthpart, like a mosquito, and they are penetrating your skin and sucking your blood, that's what most of those critters are doing. And so it's a different kind of bite reaction. So, yeah, there is often that confusion. The true Japanese beetle eats roses. The Asian lady beetle eats aphids, but on occasion it will invade your house. And as I said, the person is experienced, they will bite. I do remember when they first came in the state, when I first heard that a ladybug bit, I didn't believe it. But it doesn't take long to experience them to know that, yes, in the fall they do bite.
Well, let's take a call. Chris in Burlington, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Good afternoon. So I wanted to make a comment, which led to a question. About 5 years ago, there had to literally be 5,000 butterflies on the road. It was like a National Geographic picture. It was just jaw-dropping. And cars were just driving through, and I was saddened by it. So I've been doing everything I can to feed butterflies. Now, my question is, the milkweed that grows wild in my yard, on the south side of my house, they grow pods with seeds, but on the north side they do not. Why is that? Do you know?
Well, I would think it's just, you know, environment, that in the south side with more heat they develop quicker, they mature faster, might be a way of thinking of it. Where in the north side, I wonder if they are held back enough because of lack of sunlight and the like that they never get to the point of flowering, and if they don't flower, then you can't produce the pods. That would be my guess. Now, it could be some soil factors and other things that might complicate that, but north versus south, as I said, I start worrying about sunlight, first of all.
Yeah, that's a good response. Thank you, Chris. Charlene in Dane, it's your turn. Hi, Charlene.
Hi, thank you very much. Hey, I've got a cabin up in Oneida County, and this spring I found little piles of frass and called a pesticide company, and they said it was powder post beetles. And they recommended, and I did the spraying. They did the spraying with Boracare. How effective is that?
It is very effective if it can penetrate the wood. Basically, what has to happen is the borates have to soak into the wood, and then, honestly, they will stay there, especially indoors where you're not washing away. Outdoors, you get a little bit concerned. So the question usually is again, was it rough sawed, unfinished? That would be the preference because it soaks in better. If there was a moderate finish on the wood, then I get concerned that it never penetrates. Outdoors, what often happens is as things weather, it works just fine, but then it's worth putting some kind of sealant or other things so that once it's in the wood, it won't wash out with, you know, years of rain and the like. So it's a neat product because borates, as long as you don't eat them, are pretty much non-toxic to people. And so that was definitely the right product to use. But as I said, my question usually is was the wood prepared properly so that you'd get the most bang for your buck from the treatment.
Yep. There you go, Charlene. Thank you. Polly in Milwaukee. Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, I have a question about cocoons. I found three cocoons in my yard as I was raking leaves. They were just loose in the leaves. And do you know if you can identify the butterfly or moth by the cocoon?
How big was the cocoons?
It was about 2-2.5 inches.
Okay.
They were white.
So they're wild silkworms, and because you found them on the ground, I'm guessing it's either most likely Polyphemus, could be Luna. Cecropia moths also make big silkworm cocoons, but they're typically in the twigs and branches of plants above ground. So look up wild silkworm, and you should see it. But as I said, I bet you Polyphemus would be my first guess from finding them in that situation. Now, in order to get those to emerge, you might think you're doing them a favor if you leave them in the house, but you're not, because they need a cold shock to develop properly. And so typically, you know, I put them in a container and put them out in the garage and just let them go through a natural cooling process, then the natural warming up in the spring. And with that in mind, you'll probably get them emerging in May or June. As I said, I was lucky enough to find a cocoon on a walk last year, and I went through that process and gave it to my grandson, and we did it getting emergent. Now, he had to be a little patient because I'd get, you know, a call every day or two that wasn't coming, and all of a sudden it happened. So that was pretty neat.
Oh, man. Charlene, thank you very much for calling. Polly in Milwaukee, what's on your mind? Polly in Milwaukee, are you there? Oh, I'm sorry. Let's see. Paula in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Paula.
Hi. I'm 78, and when I was growing up, when my children were growing up, lightning bugs were all over the place in the summer. And anymore, I don't see them. I mean, there's one here and one there, and it makes me sad. I just wondered if they're decline, or that's my question.
Yeah,
thanks.
No, it things change in individual neighborhoods, but I will tell you, I see more lightning bugs in my neighborhood in the last few years than I remember as a kid. But you know, I was living 4 miles away. Generally, when I go to look for them, I tend to go more into marshy swamp areas. They are predators in the larval stage on millipedes and the like. It depends on the species of lightning bug. But so, yeah, if you get in the right spot, they really are quite common. So I have not seen anything to suggest that their populations, and we have multiple species in the state, are in any kind of major decline. But, you know, in most urban settings, because we're changing the environment and, you know, all the building and whatnot, that's not the best habitat for it. Now, what might help me, again, I had mentioned earlier, I had a golf course that also has a, you know, big retention pond and kind of a swampy area within a couple blocks. And I'm sure that's one of the reasons I see quite a few fireflies in the mid to late summer. And again, there's more than one species I know that it's popping around in my backyard.
Yeah, I've got a lot of them in mine. Yeah, thanks, Paula. Appreciate it. Well, Alan in Rhinelander, what's on your mind?
Hi. Two quick questions. One is there an easy way to keep the Asian beetles from getting inside your home in the summertime? And the second one is during the summer, there's a little white, it looks like droppings from underneath the soffit on decks and it's right in front of the your exterior wall of your house. I'm assuming that's some kind of little bug, but I never find them up above on the soffit. Any ideas?
You don't witness any holes or anything else coming out from the soffits? Do you have siding, wood siding, or what?
A vinyl. It reminds me of little black dots from flies, you know, when they deposit. Who knows?
Well, we'll ponder that. Alan, let me ask you, do you have an outside light near there?
Well, we have a yard light that's in the soffit that shines down, but it's not on all the time.
Okay, well, that might help. We'll ponder that because we need to take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today on the program with our guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, a distinguished faculty associate emeritus. Great to have him back. Larry Mueller here. Questions for Phil, give a call, 800-642-1234, or email at ideas@wpr.org. And as we broke for news, Alan had a question or two, one related to controlling Asian lady beetles in summer.
And then the other one, it was these spots. In my thought on the spots, it doesn't. When we get this kind of question, it sometimes turns out that the spots are not related to insects, but are the spores of artillery fungus. Artillery fungus shoots its spores, and these darn things stick on the siding of your house, and they leave little dark round spots that some people would think is, you know, spider waste or other insect waste. And honestly, it gets almost to the point that like it's glued on, and we've had cases where it has literally caused some damage to the siding. So that would be my first thought to look to see. But as I said, they are dark colored. Now, Alan mentioned it was kind of white, and that doesn't quite fit. So as far as the Asian lady beetles, it's all about thinking of all the little cracks and crevices that they can crawl into. So you have to check all your vents to make sure that the screen is small enough mesh that they can't get through. What I find in a lot of newer homes is the soffits are just a plastic or metal grate that falls down in the interface between where that meets the siding of the house or meets your eaves and the like. There's a space for critters to go through, and you know, insects are pretty good at weaseling through things, and so those are the kind of seams that you have to, in all your window frames, you have to look to make sure that there's no seams that something can crawl into. So it's usually caulking and sealing, and you know, sometimes it helps to have somebody who really understands building to know where all these weak spots can be. But the argument is if you can build these things out, you keep the cluster flies, the Asian lady beetles, the stink bugs, I mean, all these critters that are fall invaders, box elder bugs are another example. It's all about sealing those seams and cracks and crevices so that they can't get in your walls or your attic, and if they can't get there, then they will not show up in your house.
Mary emailed to ask, what happens to spiders in the wintertime?
Depends on the species. There are spiders, believe it or not, that can live for 3 or 4 years, so they have to overwinter. But usually they will crawl into a sheltered place and hibernate, if you think of. We call it diapause in insects. There are other ones like, you know, this orb weaver that we talked about, the famous Charlotte's Web spider, that the females die out and they overwinter as eggs, and then they start as young baby spiders in the spring and then take all year, all summer long to mature and have the next generation. So it's kind of a combination of things. It's that some can live a long time and have to live in protected environments. The one that amazed me are some of the cellar spiders and stuff that you find in your basement where they seem to just kind of hang on. But if you think about it, you know, basements and whatnot are probably not that much different than caves, which are a pretty interesting environment for spiders to be in. And again, when the temperatures are cool, they're not using as much energy so that they don't need as much food. And so that kind is a way of surviving those kind of hostile conditions.
Speaking of spiders, Ken in Libertyville, Illinois, wondered if those white spots under the eaves may be spider droppings.
It could be. You know, where I see this more often than not is homes close to lakes, because your night lights attract so many aquatic insects, and spiders take big-time advantage of that. Although usually it's pretty apparent, because most of the spiders in that situation are leaving some kind of webbing or tubing, and so you can see that, you know, and correlate it with the spots that are there. And especially, you know, that's a constant enough environment, it's always there, and it's a big problem. Once you get away from the water, I don't normally see enough insects being attracted. But if that's the case, you know, one of the solutions, and we do this in industrial settings and the like, you know, where you're worrying about insect contamination. If you think about it, the worst place to put a security light is right on top of the door, because you draw all the insects, spiders, whatnot, to the door, and then they can get in the building. Whereas if you put it on a pole and shine the light to the door, you still get the security side of it, but you're attracting all the insects away from the building to the pole. So, you know, sometimes there are those kind of adjustments that can make a difference for some of these problems.
Pat in Colgate emailed to ask you to comment on the National Native Bee Citizen Science Project. This group is copying the bird count model to get data about native bees. Are you familiar with that?
Somewhat. I mean, there has been a whole lot of stuff that has been coming out lately of kind of citizen scientist types of projects to get involved with. And I know I've seen something in the last couple of weeks show up. I haven't got into a lot of depth and detail, but I think there's opportunities for people to get involved. And, you know, one of the things that's important here is helping people identify some of these native bees, because, you know, they don't all look like honeybees and the like. And so a lot of these programs and projects have help in identifying stuff, you know, the various guides and like, and that makes it more interesting, much like, again, with birds. If you're a birder, you know, the most important thing is to know what species you got. And then again, once you understand the environment or the requirements of that one particular critter, you can start to manipulate things in their favor.
A listener emailed to ask you to talk about the state of the SWD bug. I'm not sure what the SWD...
Spotted-winged Drosophila.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Go,
any comments on that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. With not being in the lab, I don't get near the number of questions. I don't grow raspberries, so I have not had a problem with it. So, you know, spotted winged Drosophila came on to us about 15 years ago. It is a fruit fly, and what makes it unique is that it lays its egg in fruit, which all fruit flies do, but instead of being overly ripe fruit that's fallen apart, it's laying its eggs in fruit just as it starts to color. So when you harvest the raspberries or other susceptible fruit, and most of it is, you know, blueberries, some of the thin skin fruit, you bring it in with you, and you've already lost the war is the problem. You know, you look at the bowl and you see the little white maggots crawling out. And so what has happened is, in order to stop this, you start to spray your fruit relatively early. Now, we haven't had a lot of problems in strawberries in the state. They don't seem to come on as early in our state as they do other places. I tend to see mostly activity coming on in July and later. Dr. Christelle Grudeau, who is an entomologist, our fruit entomologist at the university, has been in quite a bit of studying. So I would suggest to go to Christelle's website. I'm sure she's got more up-to-date stuff on what's going on and some of the experiments that they're doing. trying to better understand the dynamic. But we got caught in this country very quickly. I mean, that thing went from a non-issue to being throughout the United States in a little over 2 years.
Yeah. Anne in Eagle called to say she had an infestation with potato beetles last summer. Was that a big issue around the state?
Well, again, I kind of look at everything historically. When I was a graduate student, Colorado potato beetles were impossible to find. But they have become much more commonplace, and it's a combination of them becoming resistant to many of the standard treatments. But the way it seems to be is people can be growing potatoes for 15 years and never see them. But once they show up, they don't go away, has been my experience. And as I said, you got to be a little careful in what you're going to use, because the products that were recommended 15 years ago, I probably don't have a lot of faith in. But there are some products, even some organic products, that are quite effective. And so the Colorado potato beetle overwinters as an adult, and it crawls into your potato patch relatively early. And it's the eggs from that overwintering generation that get you. And so we're talking in June. Relatively early in June, you should be looking at potatoes, turn the leaves over. You see these yellowish little clusters of eggs. That tells you it's starting. Their larvae are these little, they eventually get brick red, but these kind of slimy little fat worms. And it's better to kill the larvae. Now, one of the problems, because there's another generation, if you let this go to the first week of July, when you treat, you kill these immatures that are on your plant, but if the beetles that have matured enough have already went into the ground, they will not be affected. They come out a week later and lay eggs, and you got another wave. And the difference is the spring generation is all on the same timing. So if you got your timing right, one treatment usually makes a big difference. Late in the summer, the problem is that there are various life stages, some susceptible, some not, and it's a much more difficult problem to control. So it's all about going out there in June and stopping it. And as I said, there's a number of products, including organic products, that work, but it'd be up to date. I know the spinosad product that's out there is probably as good as any right now that is both organic and effective, whereas the old garden insecticide 7 that, you know, we've been using for 40 years type of thing, I don't expect it to work against it. They are resistant. And that and a number of the other commercial products, the commercial potato growers are always wrestling with trying to stay ahead of that critter.
Richard in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Richard. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks. Great show. I had a question about, we live in an area where there's a holding pond, and it's probably 20 meters wide by probably 60 meters long. And unless it's over like 3-4 feet, it won't empty. So we have tons and tons of mosquitoes. And I've just been over the years trying to figure out a way to deal with it. And I know, of course, the mosquito fish, but then it's a pond that dries. My question was in regards to dragonfly larvae, because I understand they're very, very aggressive. But tell me if I'm correct. Apparently, they're in the larva form for years, and so if it dries out, they would also die?
Yeah, different species.
You know, anything else?
Yeah, no, there are different species. The problem, it's hard to manipulate them. People have looked at that because they would make, I always say dragonflies are much better than purple martins in controlling mosquitoes. They just don't get the good press. But I think another thing to look at, two things. I mean, sometimes the ponds should be constructed in a way that it we always tell people that 95% of the mosquitoes come from 5% of the water, and it's usually more kind of flooded ditches and the like that are more problematic. So, as you say, you know, in a more permanent environment where you've got fish, they are their major predator, and they often prevent mosquitoes from taking over. But one of the products you can consider that they use is, again, there is a bacterial insecticide. They sell it as briquettes and other things that you can treat the pond with when the water is up, and the larvae ingest it and it kills them. But again, it doesn't affect frogs and other things that are in the environment. The trouble is from the size of this. I mean, you might be talking a cost that was maybe more appropriate for a neighborhood association to deal with or the like. But one of the things I would, you know, to make sure that that's the direction you got to go is have somebody who knows what they're doing sample the water when the larvae should be there. If you find mosquito larvae, you say, yeah, I got a problem, I need to deal with it. But if you can't find any larvae, that may not be the habitat. And that's the frustration with mosquitoes in Wisconsin, is that the biggest problem mosquitoes are migrating in from 10, 15 miles down the road. And as I said, they're usually associated with temporary flooding. If things dry up in 4 or 5 days, that's not a problem. If things stay more permanent, as we talked about lakes and permanent ponds, those tend not to be the environment. It's these things that go for about 2 to 3 weeks before they dry up that I get nervous about, because that's the kind of, you know, gunky, slimy water that mosquitoes tend to favor. But those mosquito products would work. And said they sell them as little briquettes or little discs that you can throw in small fish ponds and the like, and really are very effective at preventing that from being mosquito habitat. So, you know, it's definitely an alternative. But before I would go that way, I would have somebody make sure that that is a breeding site, because, as I said, it may not be.
And you can get a lot of mosquitoes out of a, you know, something the size of like a cup of water, can't you?
Well, the number I remember from graduate school and Gene DeFolliart was 100 mosquitoes per square foot of water of suitable habitat. Now, most things aren't that suitable per se, but yeah, you can breed a whole lot of mosquitoes. And as I said, our floodwater mosquitoes are notorious for going 15, 20, 30 miles. And that's what makes it so problematic, is that you're talking about a very large geographical area. And because we historically have not had disease issues in our state, we have never developed these big abatement districts, these big control districts that are more common in the South. Even in Illinois, there's a lot of areas where they do. And what they have done is identified these special breeding sites that they can go monitor and then deal with when the conditions are right. Because I said, you know, if you just treat all the water there, you're treating a lot of stuff that's not suitable. But if you know where these hot spots are, now in Madison, historically, they have done a little bit of stuff with some of the mosquitoes that spread West Nile disease, but that's a very selective environment, and they were looking at very selected places that they would treat. They were not treating for nuisance mosquitoes. They were treating specifically for disease-spreading mosquitoes.
Diane in Shatek, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Diane.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to have a comment about those Asian beetles we were talking about. I remember when they arrived maybe, I don't know, 18 years ago, I have a dark brown house facing the sun in the late afternoon. And when they first started to come, I would have to vacuum up about 100 to 200 a day in my house, which was insanity. So I finally started spraying the outside of my house, which has helped, but they still get in. And my comment is that since that time, I have developed quite an allergy to them. I had read when I was researching that the feces of the Asian beetle is 10 times worse than that of a dust mite, if you have dust mite allergies, which I did. And that's about all I have to say, is that they're more than just a pest. They are not very helpful for me. I'm still sneezing and coughing, and I'm finding them still in my house, even after they've died. There's some of them have survived and made their way in. So
the problem is, you know, if I told you it killed 95% of the ones that came in, I'd be excited because we had so much success. But the 5% that remain still make you sick. And so it's a numbers game. When they come in by the tens of thousands, things do sneak by. And you're right. You know, when you bother an Asian lady beetle, and this is common to many species of lady beetles, they bleed through their joints, a very foul-smelling, tasting, you know, yellowish to brownish liquid, and that's what keeps other predators away from them, and that's what people are developing allergies to. So, you know, when you start throwing foreign proteins in your environment, that's what your body reacts to, and not all of us are sensitive, but I remember, again, this even goes into the late 90s, that the people of University Hospital and the Veterans Administration were looking into that as a major concern. And I know people who have bought a beautiful place out in the country and all of a sudden they get invaded, and it's become as much of a health issue that they've had to sell their home because they just couldn't tolerate it. So spraying is definitely an option. It kills a lot, but ultimately, if you're lucky, you can find how they get in and lessen the numbers there. That helps. But it's not possible all the time. If you've got an old farmhouse and I tell you to seal it up, you're going to laugh at me because there's just no way you can tighten it up enough. But sometimes during reconstruction, when you know, they put on vinyl siding, they use these house wraps, Tyvek and the like, and that kind of stuff helps because it presents a barrier. But I still get nervous around vents and door frames and window frames because that's a place critters can get in.
Yeah, for sure. Diane, thank you. Kathy in Lake Delton, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there. I have a small little vegetable garden, and I have a few flowers in there, too. And I've never seen this before, but in August, late summer, a black beetle with a neon green stripe down the back and then a teat at the head just ravaged my garden. Everything was eaten up. The leaves were gone, the kale, the cabbage. The only thing is, which was unusual, it did not touch the tomatoes. So I don't know what it was, but I don't want to have it back next year. So
how big was the beetle? Tiny, middle size, real big?
No, it was just a little bigger than an Asian beetle.
Okay. I'm thinking, with the plants that you mentioned, things that are in the crucifer family, you know, the cabbage and the broccoli and the like, there's a critter I know is the red turnip beetle that kind of comes on like that, and it just devours that, but it will not feed on tomato. It's very selective. Now, could it be another species of leaf beetle? Yes, because there's, you know, hundreds of species of beetles. But I think, first of all, the importance of what you observed of what it eats and what it doesn't eat gives you a little bit of a hint. So let's just assume that it is a species of leaf beetle, and whether it's turnip beetle or other one, it's not that important. Again, looking at potential products that would help you, an organic product that has good beetle activity is this. I know it as under the active ingredient spinosad, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. It's sold under Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew and other products. There's a number of things. So you're just looking for something with the spinosad in it. And that's very effective. But what you'd have to do is when they first start coming on, the first wave, that's when you want to shut the door and treat. And in the case of turnip beetle, what's curious, it's more of a spring thing. So that's why I'm thinking it's not. But turnip beetle feeds on wild mustard, which is a very common weed in the spring. And when it devours all that, it migrates. And so if you've got a garden next to a, you know, big field that has a bunch of wild mustard, it seems like it's a wave of critters coming, and it's because they're coming off. They've exhausted their food source, and they're coming in to feed on your cabbage and broccoli, and that's all they're going to feed on and the like.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it's something similar, that there might be a weed host that's breeding a lot of these critters, and then when they eat all the weeds up, then they're coming on to your plants that they like to feed on. But as I said, I think somehow mark your calendar. You know, you want to be early in this game that, you know, if it seemed to happen towards the middle of July, then it'd be worth going out and examining your plants pretty close to see if you got to intervene.
Kathy, thank you so much for calling. And Phil, boy, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. Good to hear your voice. I hope this is the next time we meet, maybe we'll be able to do it in person. Who knows?
Yeah, we might even be able to tell each other stories. Who knows?
Yeah, I know it. I'm missing all those stories. Thanks, Phil.
Okay.
Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus at UW-Madison, our guest. Tomorrow at this time, Tom Wilmoth is back to talk about, he's with us for our annual holiday music show. That's going to be a lot of fun. And that's at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please do stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.